Hello and welcome back to the Flutter's Travel Health Podcast. Thank you for tuning in with us this week. I'm Jason Komet, and this week Jaden and I will be discussing Japanese encephalitis.
Yeah, we wanted this to be a bit of a resource for those of you like myself who might not be that familiar with Japanese encephalitis and maybe want to know a bit more about it. So, what is Japanese encephalitis and how do you catch it?
Okay, so Japanese encephalitis is a mosquito carried virus. So what would basically happen, and as it happens with so many other illnesses, it seems, you know, a mosquito carries it, it would bite you and then essentially inject the virus into your system, and then you would be infected and sick with this pathogen. So what basically will end up happening here, it is carried by the Culex type mosquito, which is actually quite similar to the types of mosquitoes that we have in Canada, for example. And it's carried basically throughout the different parts of Asia, starting, you know, obviously in Japan, I guess is where the name came from, but it goes all the way down into the equator type areas of Asia. So really the range is different based on when mosquitoes are active. So if you think about countries in the northern areas, more like Japan and that sort of thing, they are only have a risk of Japanese encephalitis during their mosquito months. Meanwhile, if you go closer to the equator, you go to Indonesia, for example, where it's mosquito season all year long, the risk can be pretty much year round.
Right. So if you happen to be traveling in one of those areas during one of those seasons and you're bitten by one of these mosquitoes, how long would it take before you started to show symptoms?
Typically speaking, so with Japanese encephalitis, 99% of people have no symptoms and really you're infected and nothing happens. That's
right.
That's the group you want to be in. You want to be in the 99%. But if it was a situation where you were developing symptoms, it's usually about a week to 2 weeks to get symptoms. And then, you know, what ends up happening is it's inflammation of the brain. So anything associated with that, you know, gets a pretty severe illness at that point. And so 1% probably of people that get infected will develop symptoms. And of that 1%, you can usually divide that out into three equal groups. Of about 1/3 of the people that have symptoms will recover and be just fine. But 1/3 of that group will recover, but they'll have long-term neurological problems, and 1/3 of that group will die. So it's a pretty grim outcome for a very small percentage of people, but it's a little scary that way.
Right. So what would be some of those symptoms that you might develop if you happen to be in this kind of unlucky group of people that does end up developing symptoms?
Essentially, it starts off with, you know, headache, fever, vomiting. But what ends up really happening is as their inflammation really starts to increase in your brain, you will develop disorientation, seizures, and ultimately, usually often will fall into a coma at that point. And really, there's no specific treatment, symptomatic treatment only, and just hope your body can fight off the infection.
Right. And are most people kind of in a situation where it's recommended that they like go into a hospital or seek medical attention in that sense, like in a very serious way, rather than just, you know, going to see their family doctor?
Oh yeah, you could potentially be really sick, and you would, if you were having seizures or some kind of weird other neurological things, it would definitely be causing lots of red flags, and you would be probably heading it to the nearest ER.
Right. And so you mentioned that there is kind of like those three groups of people who, and some of them will recover. Is there sort of like any long-term effects, any sort of thing that can kind of follow you around for the rest of your life as a result of having Japanese encephalitis?
Well, the types of long-term deficits that you can have are mostly neurological. So it could be, you know, some kind of seizure problem or some kind of, you know, with problems with your memory, speech, you know, body weakness and on one side, perhaps, like those kinds of things, like, you know, kind of almost like stroke-like symptoms are going forward. So it's pretty grim from that standpoint.
Right. And is there, in that sense, is there a group of people or like an age group or a type of person who would be more likely to have a serious case?
Like, I don't think you can narrow it down necessarily to a specific age or a specific group. What we know is it's more based on location. We find that these mosquitoes that carry Japanese encephalitis are far more likely to be in more remote destinations, more agricultural. They're not a mosquito that loves the city. So, you know, I am more concerned if people are spending extended periods of time in rural areas, agricultural areas, especially if you're potentially like tenting or something like that, and you're going to be outside a lot in the dusk and dawn hours because that's when these mosquitoes are more active. The right. longer you're in these areas, I guess the longer, the more likelihood that you could be potentially exposed. But this is an illness which, although it does happen from time to time, typically speaking, it's not something that you would you're as likely to get in the heart of downtown Bangkok or something like that.
Right, right. So it's not really like an urban type of disease the way that something like dengue fever is or anything else, those type of mosquitoes that kind of like to, as we've mentioned before, hang out in the city and where there's tires full of water and lots of humidity and stuff
exactly.
like that. They're more like a traditional type of mosquito that we would think of that hangs out.
Totally.
Would it be more something you're more likely to come into contact with, say, if you're the type of person that has family in Asia and you're going to stay with them or something like that? That would be rather than if you're just going kind of like for a fun trip or a short trip.
I think if you're in a situation where you're going for a short trip and you're going to be doing, say, if you're going for business and you're going to be mostly indoors doing meetings, that sort of thing, or if you're going to be going to mostly common tourist destinations and for, you know, a period of a couple few weeks or something in that length, your risk is, it's not zero, but it's pretty low. We know that, you could get incredibly unlucky, and if you are one of the people that just happens to get bit at the, it could happen, and it's a potential risk. But if you look at historically the travelers that have contracted Japanese encephalitis, I know there was a case a little while back where it was somebody who was in Phuket in Thailand, and they were just your typical traveler who was there having fun and not doing any kind of really extreme off the beaten path type adventures.
Right.
So it's not, like I said, the estimated risk of getting Japanese encephalitis as a tourist is, you know, really low. But as I like to tell people when we do appointments, the risk is low. It's not zero. And the thing about it that is always going to be a little bit concerning is that once you get it, there's not much you can do. Your body has to fight it off the best you can. So that would be an argument in favor of potentially doing the vaccine for that, because the vaccine is effective and it will help prevent you from getting infected.
Right. So how often would you say you recommend or that people decide to get the vaccine?
It's not super common. Every time we have an appointment where someone's going to this part of the world, we'll talk about it, discuss it. Right. The thing about Japanese encephalitis vaccine is that it's really expensive. And so if you're going on a trip like this, and whenever we have people coming in for appointments, like, we always have to look at the economic, the cost side of this. Like, it's one thing to say you should get this vaccine and that vaccine, but there's a cost associated to all this stuff. And most people's budgets for an appointment like this is not unlimited. So
right.
lots of times we'll talk about, you know, what's the risk? What's the benefit based on the cost? You know, you're looking at basically right around $250 per dose, and it's a two-dose series. So you're looking somewhere in the order of close to $500 to get this vaccine per person. Now, of course, if you have a drug plan, you know, at our clinic, you know, we direct bill. So sometimes we can put it through someone's drug plan and see if it'll cover. If it covers 80%, it might, you know, it might help tip the scales on whether they want to get it or not. But These are considerations that, you know, we have to make sometimes just because, you know, sort of the reality of the situation. If the risk is relatively low, you can make the cost benefit analysis essentially, and you have to kind of decide what to do.
Right. And do you find that there's people that are, say, particularly risk averse, or people who are really, really concerned about it that do end up getting it despite it being expensive? Or do you find that normally people, once they find out that it's kind of, they're at low risk in most areas, that they are less likely?
Yeah, well, risk tolerance is very different amongst different people. And so we absolutely have people getting it done that, the risk might not be super high, but they want to eliminate it down to virtually nothing. And that's okay. The nice thing about Japanese encephalitis vaccine is the risks associated with it are pretty limited. It's a pretty well-tolerated vaccine. The side effect profile on it is pretty minimal. So we don't really have to look at it from the standpoint of, is this vaccine going to cause a lot of problems? The main side effect is pain in the pocketbook, you know, as I sometimes joke around to tell people. But when it comes right down to it, that's kind of where you're at with it more often than not. I've said before, if this vaccine was $50 a dose, and two doses, like, we would do it way more often than we do it now, but it's not, so we don't.
Right. So this maybe is a little bit of a different sort of question, but do you know sort of in the vaccination campaigns of other countries, whether that is a common thing that people have? Is it like for citizens of somewhere like who people who live in Indonesia or who live in Japan that might be more regularly exposed or at risk for something like this? Is it part of their vaccination campaign? Is it common? Is it not common?
Yes, actually, what you're talking about is, I can't list you off a exact list of countries, but there are definitely some countries in that part of the world where this is part of your typical vaccine program. You would be getting it like how we get tetanus or measles or as part of our routine vaccines. In some areas of Asia, Japanese encephalitis is just part of your routine kid shots.
I feel like that's kind of a good idea. I don't know. I was researching this a little bit, and it was definitely, despite how, 99% of cases are asymptomatic, it's very scary that, say 1 in 4 cases are fatal. And in saying that, is it potentially possible, given that we have a similar type of mosquito in Canada, would it be possible for it to be brought into Canada?
Even though we have mosquitoes that are very similar, the chances of it really being established here is pretty limited overall. Now, these mosquitoes, the Culex mosquitoes, it's a different subtype of mosquito that carries Japanese encephalitis in Asia than what we have in North America. But
right.
Essentially, in many ways, those mosquitoes have a lot of similarities, but it would be quite difficult for it to establish itself because it's not a disease where you can easily do it, where a mosquito can bite an infected person and then infect someone else. So the risk seems somewhat unlikely, but these mosquitoes are much more similar to a Canadian mosquito than some of the other mosquitoes. For example, when we start thinking about an Anopheles mosquito or an Aedes mosquito, which carry other diseases. So probably not, but which is good.
That is good. That puts my mind at ease a little bit.
One thing I was going to mention is in that same token, with the mosquitoes that we have that are very similar, a lot of times I try to explain to people that Japanese encephalitis in a lot of ways has a lot of similarities to West Nile virus. Now,
right.
Most Canadians have at least some level of knowledge about West Nile. West Nile is not an illness that originated in Canada, obviously based on its name, but it's something that we've had now for quite a few years that's been transmitted and brought to our part of the world. And West Nile is a virus carried by that type of mosquito. And again, it's like a thing that is rare. Like you typically, people can get infected with West Nile virus. The vast majority of those people will never have any symptoms, but every now and then there'll be somebody who will have long-term neurological problems. And, you'll hear about stories. They're pretty rare, but you'll hear about some random person in Saskatchewan that got Japanese encephalitis and has long-term paralysis as a result, and it makes the news. Well, it makes the news because it's so rare, fortunately, but it does happen occasionally.
Right. And how did West Nile virus get here? Was it that the mosquitoes came here, or was it that someone who had West Nile virus came back to Canada and then a mosquito bit them?
You know, I'm actually not completely certain. I seem to remember somehow the illness was imported across the ocean, and I think it originated in the New York area, and it's worked its way across the continent. And, you know, it's relatively been more in Canada, more in Manitoba, Saskatchewan. There's been some cases in Alberta, but it hasn't really firmly got a foothold in the West. It seems like every now and then we see, you know, we'll see a little bit more of it here and there one year as opposed to another. But yeah, good question. Actually, I should do a little bit of research on the history of it myself.
Yeah, I just get curious about it because there's so many different mosquitoes that carry so many different types of diseases. And I think that a lot of people here, we have these kind of like boring non-tropical type of mosquitoes. And I always wonder, you know, what if, you know, one of these other types of mosquitoes got over here and then we started having problems.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, for sure. So a couple things I wanted to mention about the Japanese encephalitis vaccine, because I did briefly mention that it's two doses and it's pretty well tolerated. Thought I'd give a couple more bits of info. So the two doses, originally we were doing them 28 days apart, but we actually know now that we can do them just 7 days apart. So you get your one dose, you get your second dose as quickly as a week later, and then you really need two doses in your system to have adequate protection. And then after you've had your two doses, we know you're covered off for about a year or two. And right now, the recommendations have changed so that if you think you're going to be traveling to Asia on a regular basis and you want to sort of lock in some longer-term protection, if you get a third dose between 12 and 24 months after your first two, then you should have protection for at least 10 years. But if you get your two doses of Japanese encephalitis vaccine and then you wait, say, 3 or 4 years, then you would redo the series is what it would amount to. You'd have to do the two doses again. And from a side effect standpoint, you know, it's an inactivated vaccine. So it's more your typical arm soreness and arm tenderness. Those are the kinds of things you're looking at. So like I said, pretty well tolerated overall. And typically speaking, the adverse events are pretty limited.
Right. Is there anyone who can't get it for any sort of medical reason?
No, not really. Like, I guess an allergy to one of the components of the vaccine would really be it, but it's not one of these ones where you have immune system problems, you can't get it done, that sort of thing. Like, I think pregnancy might be a possible, you would probably not so likely look at doing it in pregnancy just out of an abundance of caution. But generally speaking, most people can get it. And the age range to go for Japanese encephalitis, I believe the minimum age is, I want to say, 3 months. When you're at the really young ages, you actually give a lower dose. And I think I'll tell you right now, I don't think I've ever given it to anybody under 2 years of age. But I believe that under 2 years of age, you give a half dose. There's no junior version of Japanese encephalitis. You just use actually the syringe it comes in is marked, and you only get half the amount in the syringe. And like I said, I've been doing this for a while, and it hasn't come up yet. I'm sure at some point it will, but there is the possibility to do it for a younger age.
Right. Okay. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention about Japanese encephalitis? Anything that we missed?
Not really. There's actually a couple cool things to talk about Japanese encephalitis, sort of weird things to talk about, but about other vaccines and former vaccines. This vaccine has been around for about 10 years, but prior to this, there was another vaccine that was available in North America and had some really weird side effects. I mean, it was effective, but you would get a lot of weird headaches and stuff like that after you would get it done. And yeah, it was definitely a problem. And that's one of the reasons why this vaccine actually was developed. The American government was quite involved in developing it because they wanted to make sure that there was an adequate Japanese encephalitis vaccine for soldiers, the U.S. soldiers. So, but the old vaccine was, I actually never, right when I started doing travel medicine, it was just on the process of being on its way out, but I know it had some weird funky side effects. And so that's more just a oddball fact I thought I would throw in there. But and I think if I'm not mistaken, every time we do a Japanese encephalitis, I believe the U.S. government is getting it is their patent, I believe. So I think that they're making a few
getting
bucks
a kickback.
Off of it. They're getting a little bit of a taste of that. So
that's funny. It's always something. It's always something. The U.S. government always has their fingers in every pie.
Well, actually, historically, the American government and the National Institute of Health has been quite involved in vaccine development over the years. So it's not something which is totally weird. Like, they actually have a lot of people spending a lot of time working on some of these things. And I know that even some other vaccines that are being worked on right now that we may see in the future, they've been working, I think it's on a Zika virus vaccine as well. So yeah, anyway.
Right.
Weird tangent we took, isn't it?
A little bit, but that's cool. Was the previous one also an inactivated vaccine, or was it a live one?
It was inactivated. And,
oh, okay.
But I think the key is the reason that it had some weird side effects is I believe that the original source of how they made it is they somehow infected mice brains, and that's where they got the tissue from. So that's what one of the reasons why I think it was, like, we can just be glad that is old retired technology that we don't ever have to deal with. How about that? Let's just leave it at that.
Right. Yes. Because we were talking about the yellow fever vaccine and how that one's grown inside of a chicken egg, isn't it? Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one, you know, I think the manufacturing techniques over the years, like essentially how they make yellow fever vaccine now, as opposed to say 70 or 80 years ago, really has changed not a lot. Now, obviously I think we've got better at, you know, purity and cleanliness and sterility and stuff. Like, I think way back in the day, there were problems with some of the yellow fever doses, like early on in the 30s and 40s, but it was more about just, you know, quality control in the manufacturing. But I think that essentially the way they made it, the process is really not terribly different then as opposed to now. But yeah, with Japanese encephalitis, this vaccine is quite an advance up from what we originally had.
Right. That's good. I'm glad to hear that we've gotten rid of some of those odd side effects with the help of the American government.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Uncle Sam.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it. All right. And thank you for tuning into this week's edition of the Polaris Travel Health Podcast. A reminder that the information and advice provided in this podcast are not a substitute for live medical advice tailored to your itinerary and medical history. If you have questions or want to book an appointment, please head over to our website, www.polaristravelclinic.ca, and check us out on Twitter at @PolarisTravelRx and our Facebook page as well. We hope that you will tune in with us again next week.
Thanks, Jaden.
Thank you. We'll be right back.